You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for joining us. We're into the second hour of this live broadcast, an absolute heat wave rolling over the UK and Europe today. One of the hottest days of the year. It certainly feels like it anyway. Haven't checked the actual temperature, but just doing the link the pinky finger, stick it up to the wind, and it does feel like we're sweating bullets today on Thursday. So the air conditioning has broken down and it's not working in a lot of places, as usually the case whenever the heat wave comes. We're just not used to the hot weather. But anyway, on from that, hopefully in a couple of minutes we'll be connected with Daniel McAdams. He's a director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, based in Texas, to talk about the foreign policy misadventures of the Biden White House, but Washington in general, the two-party duopoly, and of course the big story is the FBI's raid on Donald Trump's residence in Mar-a-Lago this week. This is an unannounced raid. Certainly this crosses a few lines in terms of U.S. tradition. We'll go a little bit deeper into that with Daniel in a couple of minutes. But I mean, back to the big headlines, global headlines, and you probably heard at the top of the hour news break, I made a comment on recent comments by China regarding who's at fault with Ukraine. And they're laying blame at the feet of the United States, saying they instigated the conflict. Now, and again, we've said this before in the past, China doesn't normally weigh in on European affairs. They just don't do it. And they don't really get involved in kind of overtly picking sides or laying blame, even against the United States. Certainly that's been the case in the past. But like this rule book's been thrown out the window right now. And you think about how much saber-rattling Washington's doing against China vis-a-vis Taiwan. And think about when you watch, you know, networks like Fox News, and it's all anti-China, anti-China, the China virus, China's going to take over the world, etc. You know, if China has world domination designs, it certainly is not as manifest as the United States that has over 1,000 military facilities around the planet. China doesn't really have any outside of China. Maybe they have one. I'm not sure. So this idea that China's going to take over the world, now they're saying, well, they're going to do it economically, they're going to do it technologically. Well, there's no real evidence that that's the case. Do they want to do it economically in terms of expanding their own markets via the Belt and Road Initiative? Are they buying up ports or building infrastructure, doing these infrastructure swaps in Africa, Sri Lanka, or some of these other locations, Central America? There's a big canal project in Nicaragua. There's lots of these things going on. Well, they clearly want to facilitate markets and the movement of goods internationally in much the same way that the British and the Americans have in the past, that the French and the Portuguese, the Spanish and other empires throughout history have. So there's nothing new going on there. There's nothing new. But if you look at the progress of events in Hong Kong as an example, and now look at Taiwan, and there's two things that these have in common that I think are very much overlooked by a lot of the punditry. You know, the color revolution in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, the U.S. was fully backing that. They were sending in alternative media personalities, so-called conservatives, showing up in Hong Kong, doing these junkets for these right-wing outlets, and supposedly on the side of the democratic protesters. Now, that might be the case. There might be a democratic student movement or something in Hong Kong, but that's beside the point. When the U.S. starts flying those student leaders over to the United States and holding court in U.S. Congress, and they give American flags for these protesters, flying American flags at violent protests in Hong Kong, and basically attacking police and all the rest of it, based on what? It was an extradition law, apparently, between Hong Kong and China. That was one of the original points of protest, and it sort of spilled into a whole another sort of level of street violence. Some people were set on fire by these pro-democratic reformists led by Joshua Wong. Okay. and attacking people with umbrella spears and things like that. All that happened. A lot of beatings took place in the street at the hands of these protesters or pro-democracy protesters. Okay. So the point is, when the U.S. gets involved, taking a side in a foreign country's domestic affairs, well, for China, that was the green light to accelerate the absorption of Hong Kong into mainland China. And I will argue that that would not have happened in that same way, or it might have happened much slower over periods of years, or maybe there would have allowed more autonomy in the long run had the United States not put itself directly involved in those events and actually funding, backing, giving support, open support to these protesters who not all of them were very pleasant and good people, and certainly not role models for democracy. Beating up civilians and elderly people is not really a good look. So Beijing took that as a cue to basically fast track maybe plans that they had over a longer period of time to absorb China and, you know, or Hong Kong into the Chinese mainland orbit and integrate it more comprehensively. The same goes with Taiwan. Nancy Pelosi's over there virtue signaling. The defense industry is racking up orders to send up new jets, new anti-aircraft, the missile defense. They're basically throwing gear and money and all sorts of support, diplomatic support for Taiwan's autonomy, they're calling it their sovereignty. Okay. And that flies in the face of the one China policy, which has been observed by previous administrations throughout history. So China is taking this saber rattling by the U.S. They watch U.S. media. Don't think that the Chinese are not watching Fox News and all the other networks. They're all doing the same thing. They're watching it closely. They take that seriously. So guess what? They're fast tracking their program to absorb Taiwan into the mainland Chinese orbit. Does this look familiar? Is Hong Kong redux, but on a slightly bigger scale? There's a bit more at stake militarily here. So Taipei is the capital of Taiwan. They're rejecting Beijing's one country, two systems proposal, saying that the only the Taiwanese people can decide their future. Now, they're within their rights to say that, but you have to understand in realist terms, you're going up against a giant force just off of your shores. It's called mainland China. So you can't give ultimatums if you're a weaker party. It just is not going to work. It works in Hollywood. It works in novels. And throughout history, though, it ends in utter defeat and failure. So just look at Ukraine. They're getting carved up as we speak. And what's going to be left is this tiny little rump state. That's they might even have some of it chopped off by Poland and some of the other European neighbors by the time they get done with, quote, Ukraine. But what did this? They fast-tracked this process. This was fast-tracked by the U.S. meddling in your Ukrainian political affairs. The Maidan revolutions, effectively U.S.-backed coup, and the U.S. uber involvement in this has fast-tracked Russia's activities to want to shore up its national security interests to protect or defend or absorb the Russian-speaking enclaves in Ukraine into the Russian world or the Russian Federation. This has all been fast-tracked by external Western actors' activities in the country. So you see a common theme. So we instigate, as the Chinese said. I think that's quite accurate. You have to agree with the Chinese officials that the U.S. is the instigator in Ukraine, the lead instigator, not the only one by any means, but the lead instigator. And this goes way back decades, okay? Back into the Cold War, in fact. Actually, back into World War II and the aftermath of World War II. And the rebuilding of Europe and in using the Nazi intelligence apparatuses as basically a Western asset, a Western intelligence asset to keep the Banderites and the Nazi factions alive and well as a potential soft underbelly in the Cold War that was to come. That's all history. That all happened. And so this is a reality. Same with China. Same with China. So the West can't decry the fact that Chinese are moving at a more rapid pace because the West also has to take responsibility for its role in antagonizing China to make it more of an urgent issue for them to move at a faster pace, to fast track their decades-long plans of gradual assimilation or absorption into the Chinese mainland orbit. The same thing happened in Hong Kong. Is everyone that ignorant about the tides of history? They can't even look at recent history to sort of recognize there's some identifiable geopolitical patterns. Hopefully we'll talk about these and more after the break when we connect with Daniel McAdams, director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. You're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
You should hear what Jesse Zerowell is talking about.
The Biden administration plans to declare the monkeypox outbreak a public health emergency in an effort to galvanize awareness and unlock additional flexibility and funding to fight the virus's spread. So it seems that round two of another viral delusion is underway. There are so many things to say about this. One of them being that while they say there are over 6,000 confirmed cases, I have yet to see anybody in the news who's been confirmed to be infected with monkeypox.
Jesse Zerowell on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I view Al Sharpton as a poverty pimp.
Terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland.
I walk outside every day in fear of white supremacy right here in the middle of the hood. Okay, yeah, right.
My grandparents had a cross burned on their property. We were slaves in the past. We're free now.
I never seen a white supremacist in my life. Never, and they can't point to one. Where the hell are they? I wish somebody would introduce me to a white supremacist. I would like to talk to them and take pictures with them because I never seen one in my life.
Biden says that the country is systematically racist. You know, I almost want to look at him and say, haven't you been the system for the last 50 years?
He's the one that sponsored the 1994 crime bill, which unequivocally basically targeted black men in black neighborhoods.
The polarization. The left versus right, the black versus white.
Pro-choice against pro-life.
I work for Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry that I scared you.
People have had to make it like they're apologizing for their whiteness.
And could you just please apologize for, you know, for your white privilege?
What's more disheartening to me is that those who are within the black community are allowing for that to take place.
So really what we're dealing with is a cultural Marxism that Joe Biden and all the rest from the left we're trying to inculcate into our society.
Well, you were once the oppressor, so now I must be the oppressor. You don't avenge evil for evil.
It's okay to say disparaging things against white people. Our former president, Barack Obama, said it, you know, about old white men are a problem, except when it comes time for him to fly around on their airplanes and ride around on their yachts or be their next door neighbors or endorse them for president like Joe Biden. Then old white men are okay. This is their last gasp.
What do progressive socialists really want?
Watch Systematic Deception at SalemNow.com.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's News Talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We're into the second hour of this live broadcast. And let me tell you, there's some big, big moves afoot in the United States right now. We're running up to the midterm elections. There's a lot at stake, not just for the parties or the candidates, but for the country as a whole. We're seeing things in the U.S. happen from a political point of view with agencies, with the Department of Justice, with the FBI, with foreign policy, the State Department, things that people never saw before in previous decades that were seen as maybe beyond the pale or over the line are now coming. commonplace. So yeah, there is a lot at stake in this election. I would say that that's going to be the case for many elections to come. And to help us get a little bit of a read on what's going on here is a very special guest, and we're very pleased to welcome to the program today the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity based in Texas. His name is Daniel McAdams, and he is joining us on the line right now. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I hope you're well. There's a lot going on. Daniel, I know that it's keeping you busy as a political commentator. You're doing a lot of live events right now. This is event season as well in many ways. Plus, you've got your regular live program with the Ron Paul Institute that you co-host with Dr. Paul. And so you've got your work cut out for you right now.
That's for sure.
And so right now, I want to start, Daniel, with, you know, the foreign policy issue, because I think that's really important. And we might hopefully comment on the recent FBI raid on the Trump residency in Mar-a-Lago this week. But, you know, where is the United States right now? Where is this administration right now with its foreign policy? The big issues right now, it seems, Daniel, are Ukraine and China. But it's hard to get a clear fix on what the objectives are of the current administration. Where do you think things are on those two fronts?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's hard to see what the objectives are, but that also depends on your perspective. You know, from a perspective of an American who's not that keen on World War III or nuclear war, there doesn't seem to be any rational objective to our policy in Ukraine and now in Taiwan, China, which seems to be a similar policy transferred over to the Far East, which is basically, you know, kick a nuclear power in the face, seems to be the policy. I don't see what we're getting out of it. The U.S. is spending billions and billions of dollars in Ukraine to fight Russia. To what end? I don't know what the end is or what it should be or what the people who are planning it have in mind. It seems to me as if this is a foreign policy that's completely devoid of anything remotely resembling America's interests.
And the last administration, and you can comment on this, it was a very different configuration in terms of the size, the amount of people. I know the Obama presidency came in and they expanded the National Security Committee to something like there was a couple of hundred staff involved in that. Some of that was retained with the Trump administration. Has there been an expansion again under the sort of the size of that body, that blob of, you know, decision makers and policy people under the Biden White House?
I'm not sure if the NSC staff has increased. You're right, it did decrease a bit under Trump, I think, from Obama. This is sort of like, you know, it used to be that the CIA was the president's, you know, private intelligence service. Now the NSC staff is. And of course, one advantage is the National Security Advisor does not need a Senate confirmation, which is sort of a workaround, which is probably why it does get more power. But you do have a lot of the retreads from the Obama administration who were busy causing a lot of problems during Obama. And by problems, I mean the 2014 coup in Ukraine, Libya, Syria. All of these people have made their way back to the administration under Biden. And in the case of Victoria Nuland, who really was a spearhead of the Ukraine coup, which we're still seeing the fallout from, obviously, she came back in a much more powerful position. And so, in my opinion, she came back with some scores to settle. She felt that 2014 was not finished and that she needed to continue this policy, sort of a Brzezinski-like policy of destroying Russia. So they're back, they're in force, they're making the same dumb mistakes they did last time. And this time it's costing us a lot more money. It may cost us even more than that.
You know, it's interesting about the impeachment. I think it was impeachment too. I'm losing track, but the Zelensky phone call, and what triggered that whole farrago was that Trump was apparently holding up an arms shipment of Javelin missiles, among other things, to Ukraine at that time. And he was like, well, you know, we got a corruption problem in Ukraine. Maybe we should sort of, you know, let's find out what's going on there. And, you know, the accusation was that he was threatening to withhold lethal aid, as they call it, to Ukraine. Now, that was 2 years ago. So looking at how things unfolded in the last 6 months, it does seem a little bit, Daniel, and I know this might sound conspiratorial, that this conflict or wanting to bait Russia into action was something that has already begun years before. What do you think about that, looking back at that second impeachment attempt?
Yeah, I don't even think we have to worry about it being conspiratorial, because it's just a fact. And we heard it from the hearings surrounding the impeachment. We heard people. Basically, the complaint about Trump was that he was going against the interagency consensus by attempting to transform or to change U.S. policy toward Taiwan, which is a pretty bizarre thing when you think about it. The president of the United States, the one constitutional power the president does have is the power over foreign policy. So the idea that a president is challenged, we heard it from this Colonel Vindman character and several others, that this president is not allowed to change the interagency consensus, is really a peek behind the screen at the raw power of what we call the deep state.
Yes, that is the permanent state, the deep state, and it's all these functionaries and people that are in appointed positions that seem to be consistent from administration to administration. The thing that I was blown away about with the Trump administration was how many of these previous administration holdovers were still embedded in the National Security Council, including vehement anti-Russians. A whole slew of them, and pro-Ukrainian as well. And it just seemed like the deck was completely stacked. It was stacked from the beginning. And every time the last president, Trump, 45, every time he made a move, like, we need to pull our assets out of Syria, all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose. Lindsey Graham's on Fox every 5 minutes saying how this just can't happen. Everybody's going crazy. And then Trump withdraws that sort of policy or walks back that statement every time. And then he's left with empty cabinet positions, and people like John Bolton are just standing there like bridesmaids waiting for the call. And Elliot Abrams, all the retreads, the neocon retreads are there. It was almost like maybe the Trump administration wanted to exert some executive authority on foreign policy, but in the end was basically undermined and unable to really do anything effectual on that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of summing it up. One of the problems we have in the U.S. foreign policy community, well, there are a couple problems. The first one is people who get into the business to settle old family scores. Victoria Nuland is Ukrainian, and she, for some reason, is of that Ukrainian variety that's particularly virulently anti-Russian. So I don't know what happened with her grandparents or great-grandparents. Obviously, the world is not fair, but it does seem to me that she's dragging some of her own history into her perspectives on this. And that happens a lot with people, and it's dangerous. The other thing is a misperception. And my guess is that Trump, who's not known for his intellectual curiosity, views people in the foreign policy world as being tough. You've got to be tough. And the tough people generally are viewed as the neocons who want to have a robust foreign policy. Essentially, what they're defending and promoting, though, is an American empire that doesn't benefit the average American whatsoever. It only benefits, the special interests, the military-industrial complex, the media complex, the think tank complex, on and on and on. So you have benefits to some, to the detriment of the U.S., but there's still that misperception that if you're in the business, and I mean, I've done foreign policy as my career, and it's a handicap. As Dr. Paul always says, actually the real toughness are the people who restrain themselves from taking foreign policy action, from endorsing foreign policy action, until it can be proven that the benefits outweigh the costs. But that's still not how it's perceived. And the neocons, you know, at least in terms of their rhetoric, still have a leg up when it comes to that among a lot of people.
You know, you mentioned about, people with Ukrainian heritage occupying important positions in the State Department or, you know, key policy driving positions. Canada's Chrystia Freeland is Justin Trudeau's right hand. Some would say she's in charge and he's the right hand, but she falls into exactly that category as well. And so does the Vindman brothers, you could say, as well. Again, key positions there. So there's quite a few of that. You know what else is, a lot of people aren't aware, Daniel, that the Ukrainian lobby or the expatriate lobby in North America is very powerful, very well funded, and, you know, wields a lot of influence in Washington in terms of, well, what the U.S. policy is going to be vis-a-vis Ukraine. And that's something that doesn't get talked about very much.
No, and the sick part is that we send over billions of dollars. Millions of those dollars come back in the form of lobbying contracts. I think Ukraine right now has among the most lobbyists of any country walking the halls in Washington. So basically, the U.S. taxpayer is on the hook to pay lobbyists to propagandize American lawmakers to send more money to Ukraine to propagandize more American lawmakers. It's what my friend Chuck Spinney would call a self-licking ice cream cone.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, it's huge sums of money. That's driving policy. That's kicking congressmen into touch. It's kicking senators into touch as well. So we got a couple of minutes left before the break, and then after the break, I want to talk about the current controversy with the FBI and the former president Donald Trump. But China, on this issue of China, where it's normally the Democrats traditionally were a little more conciliatory with Beijing, not as aggressive, not as hawkish as the Republicans and the neocons might be. Certainly, Donald Trump seemed to be hawkish in his rhetoric in terms of trade wars and things like this. But now with this administration, this Democratic administration, Nancy Pelosi, they seem more hawkish on China than Trump. How did this happen?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the upcoming midterm elections in which the Democrats are expected to do badly. There's expected to be a backlash. Now, I don't know. I've seen some numbers in the Senate, and the huge GOP Senate lead is now shrinking. So you can certainly leave it up to them to blow a massive lead through their own stupidity. But nevertheless, I think a lot of this does have to do with the upcoming elections, finding some way to get some traction with the American people. And so what do you do? Well, you kick a superpower in the face. That's what you do. You know, it's one of the most bizarre and idiotic things that I've ever seen in terms of foreign policy. And like everything else this administration does, it's going to have the opposite effect. I mean, there is going to be a time where the administration thinks that it's going to ask China to do something. And they'll be surprised when China says, you know, go blank yourself because look what you did. I mean, it's almost like children are in charge. They have no sense of it's this idea that we, one of the Bush people said, you know, we are the indispensable nation. We can do it whatever we want. We can make our own reality. And there still is a good deal of that in Washington and in America, but particularly in Washington. And, you know, the rest of the world, as we're seeing by the fact that most countries have not signed on to sanctions against Russia, the rest of the world is now waking up and saying, we're getting tired of this world order.
And we're seeing also, this is interesting, you might be able to comment on, Daniel, the term decoupling from China. We're seeing deglobalization. These are terms that are being used very commonly now in mainstream media with political punditry. So what do you think they're talking about here? Is this in Great Reset terms? Is this rebalkanizing the global economy? How are you translating this?
Well, it seems like the shift is partly driven by U.S. policy, partly driven by a shift eastward. The Belt and Road Initiative, the movement of trade more toward the east. I think we're seeing that Europe has shot itself in the foot and in the head at the same time. Or is actually, as Viktor Orban said, the Hungarian prime minister, has shot itself in the lungs and sitting there gasping for air. So, you're seeing a massive, pool of energy and riches away from, quote unquote, what we used to call the West and moving eastward. And I think, there are a lot of people who don't realize it yet, but I think the implications are going to be massive in the next several years.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Hungary there. We can also throw Romania in there. Some of these Eastern European countries, if the Belt and Road Initiative, that infrastructure is built out, you start getting these connections from the Middle East via Iran into Central Asia, into Eastern Europe, via the Far East, via Russia, China to Russia. Those Eastern European countries, Balkan countries as they call them, but also the Eastern European EU countries, they stand to benefit from the improvement in the infrastructure and trade routes from Mariupol, Odessa, for instance. If Odessa comes under Russian control, that's a potential game changer. Do you think the Western powers, the traditional Western powers, are trying to build a type of an economic iron curtain there?
I think they probably have that intention, but I don't think it will be successful. And I think we've already had an inkling of this with Viktor Orban and the fact that he's refused to go along with the anti-Russia sanctions, at least when it comes to energy, to oil and to natural gas, because he doesn't want his people to freeze over the winter. I mean, I think he must be sitting there thinking, what the heck is wrong with these people? What is wrong with, with Scholz and the others, Liz Truss? Their people are going to be freezing during the winter for what? I mean, the backfire of the sanctions will be the story of the century. When you look at Russia's now trade surplus, it's massive. I think $197 billion over the last quarter, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But everything they've tried to throw at Russia to hurt Russia has only been more profitable for Russia. And I think people like Orban do understand that. I think you'd have more. You probably would have Poland to understand it. But for historic reasons, they are excessively Russophobic and won't sign on. But I think you're right. I think we'll see possibly even Serbia, which, had been bought and paid for by the West since the year 2000. Shifting more toward the east, and I think we will see more of that as we go ahead.
No, definitely. Serbia is a very interesting and important country there, and they're embroiled potentially in more sort of tensions that are arising in the Balkans that are basically latent old problems that are now resurfacing with Kosovo. The Republic of Srpska there on the side of Bosnia, Herzegovina. So I think the West could... The eye of NATO, as they say, could be turned back to the Balkans there. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, I did notice that uptake over the past couple of weeks in problems in Kosovo. Certainly the Serb population is much more pro-Russia than its leadership is. And that, I think, creates a potentially unstable situation. Will they finally be able to wake up and throw off the leaders that they've had given to them over the past 20-some years? It's a big question, but we've seen unrest in the streets. We've seen demonstrations in favor of Russia. Serbia is a historic ally of Russia. So I think, and that does make me wonder, my conspiratorial mind starts to wonder if the uptake in Kosovo is somehow related to the sentiment in Serbia. And that is, of course, a conflict that the U.S. and the powers that be can turn up and down at will. They're there, They have the strength there. They have all the secret, the secret agents there. They can easily turn up the heat when they want.
No, definitely. This is certainly a thing of concern for people in that region, because it wasn't that long ago, the dismemberment of Yugoslavia. A lot of people, it's still very fresh in their mind. But I'm here with Daniel McAdams. He's a director of the Ron Paul Institute of Peace and Prosperity, based in the United States in Texas. We're going to come back after the break here with TNT, and we're going to get into what people will say this might be the big story of the summer, and that is the FBI's raid on Trump's house in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. I'm here with Daniel McAdams. You're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You were warned. Climate lockdowns looming? Biden set to issue climate emergency in the United States.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
President Joe Biden is now seriously considering the declaration of a climate emergency in order to follow the COVID emergency. And by the way, the U.S. is still under their COVID health emergency. How long will a climate emergency last? What powers will it give Joe Biden? For those of you pining away for the COVID lockdowns, President Biden will have the ability to deploy 130 different presidential powers that require no consent of Congress. Yes, it has come to that. A permanent emergency where democracy is permanently suspended. There's only one way to fight back: the great resist. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
Our mission is to educate, inspire, and honor.
This is the sound of honor roaring. This is the sound of a generation rising above.
We want to be involved in the education of young people so that they can take the stories that our pilots tell and realize their own dreams.
The Commemorative Air Force honors the heroes of yesterday while educating and inspiring the heroes of tomorrow. You can learn more at soundsofhistory.org.
Get breaking news on your phone when it happens. Download our app from the Google Play and App Store now.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you so much for rejoining us. We're cruising into the second hour of this live broadcast, and we're very pleased to be joined on the line with a very special guest. He's the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, based in the United States. He's a foreign policy expert and a former congressional aide on the Hill to Representative Ron Paul. And Daniel, now the big story that's making waves right now, and we talked about the midterm elections coming up, and then this happens, an FBI raid on the former president's residency in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. This is his big sort of, where he holds court down in the state of Florida, his summer home, it's his base of operations. The FBI have done this raid. Not many people know much about it. Everyone's tight-lipped about it. There's only some parts of the press that are calling this out as maybe, a little bit too much. What are your initial thoughts when you heard this story?
Well, ostensibly, this is about some presidential papers that hadn't been turned into the National Archives yet. And apparently some of them may be classified. There was an act, the Presidential Papers Act, if I'm not mistaken, that was passed some decades ago that governs what presidents need to do with the documents that are produced while they're in office. And violations of which have not been punished in the past. And it's a relatively minor thing. I think President Trump delivered some 27 boxes of documents earlier this year to the National Archives. And I think President Obama took millions of documents with him to Chicago, and nothing happened. So this is not like something that is prosecuted. This is not like Hillary's server in the basement, right? Although that wasn't prosecuted either. Right. I mean, blatant abuse of classified material has not been prosecuted, yet somehow President Trump has a couple papers somewhere. At least that's what we're hearing from the media now. And there's a full-on FBI raid with automatic weapons drawn. And people, people like Matt Taibbi, who, like myself, is no massive fan of Trump by any stretch, are saying basically like, welcome to the third world. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that happens in banana republics. And that's certainly what it looks like. And from what I was have been reading this morning, they refused to show the actual search warrant. They only held it up at 10 feet distance. They demanded that everyone leave the area to be searched and that surveillance cameras be turned off. As someone else commented, you'd think they'd want them turned on, right? So they could show that what they were doing was all up on the up and up. No, they want them turned off. So everything about this is massively suspicious. It smacks massively of politicization of the FBI, the abuse of the FBI, which is what happened in the entire 4 years of the Trump presidency. You're right. I think this is the story of the year, this raid.
And, you know, we've seen a lot of crazy things, arguably, in the last couple of years, usually connected with Trump or Trump derangement syndrome or whatever you want to describe this. And this seems to me, Daniel, like this is like one of the last cards you can pull from that sort of line of activity. You know, you basically going after a president who is, by everyone's estimation, looks like he's going to announce his candidacy for the 2024 election. And it just seems like these federal agencies are doing everything possible. Not only did they do everything possible to bring down the administration in the first term, and that's all very provable right now, but now to keep him from running again in 2024. Is this beyond the pale? Is there any cards you can pull after this? Do you think this could actually work against the deep state, Democratic establishment, whoever?
Well, the funny thing about it, he wasn't even that bad. I mean, he wasn't even that much of a rebel. Yeah, he talked a good game. He said things like, what's so bad about getting along with Russia? But he went along with the assassination of Soleimani. He went along with the, you know, bombing Syria. And yeah, he didn't start any new wars and he should get some credit. But he also hired John Bolton. He hired a lot of dopes, as you mentioned earlier. So it's not like he was our hero to bring, you know, usher in an area of non-interventionism and peace and prosperity. He was a massive spender. He introduced the COVID restrictions. At least he endorsed them. He kept dopey people like Deborah Birx in power and Anthony Fauci. So what's really shocking is to see how maniacal the deep state responds to someone who really wasn't that much of a threat, you know. But the funny part is, I think there's a backlash. And as I said, I've been very lukewarm on Trump myself, but I find myself cheering. If they hate him that much, there's got to be something good about him. I'm just going to have to find it, what it is. But I think it's going to have a backlash, and people have been joking that, or at least they've been quipping that, well, you know, they basically, the FBI launched his campaign for him by doing this. And I think it's going to fire up Republican voters, this raid. So again, another own goal, I think, on the part of the bad guys.
And there's a website you're probably familiar with. It's frequented by Victor David Hansen and others. It's called American Greatness. And this was an article by Adam Mill. I think it was published just a couple of days ago. And it says, how do we get rid of the FBI? Short of abolishing the Bureau, our elected leaders must exercise their power to reimpose constitutional supremacy over this out-of-control agency. Now, that would have been extremist a couple of years ago, Daniel, but I'm seeing a lot of people saying pretty much the same thing. It's not quite defund the police, but it's almost like there's this undercurrent now of journalists and pundits saying that the FBI is no longer fit for purpose. And I haven't heard that really since the days of J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah.
What do you think about this new current?
Well, I think it's very healthy. You know, the FBI was created as a institution for one faction to fight political enemies. It's always been the case. If you go and look at COINTELPRO and all of the things that the FBI has done since its inception, it's been an evil, evil institution that never should have been formed. That being said, and Republicans being Republicans, my guess is there's a healthy group of them saying, oh, we don't want to disband it because when we get in power, we're going to use it to do the same thing. You know, we're going to own the Dems when we get power back. And that's the problem with Washington. They're addicted to power. They don't care about morality or the Constitution or common decency. So I think you're going to hear a lot. And what always happens, and you know this, Patrick, what always happens when a crisis like this occurs is that both sides get together. They circle the wagons on a term called reform. We're going to reform. You know, when we found out from Snowden that the NSA was spying on us instead of the terrorists, what did they do? They got together and said, we need to reform this, which means save our butts. And so I think that's probably what we're going to see. Maybe I'm too cynical, but at least to me, it seems like that's what we're going to see, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah, I've got a clip here from 1988, and it's from a great prophet of our times. You might recognize the voice. I'm going to play this right now and hopefully get your comment on this. But here it is.
Most of our history, we didn't have those institutions. The FBI came in during the First World War. And interestingly enough, the one thing that Woodrow Wilson did, he used the FBI to spy on American citizens and actually arrest them if they disagreed with his foreign policy about going to war in Europe. And isn't it interesting how recent they used it in the Vietnam era? Democrats used it there. Republicans used the FBI to spy on 100 different groups in this country, including the churches, who disagree with the policy in Central America. It almost looks like the FBI was designed to spy on Americans who might be disagreeing with policy, especially the foreign policy. So the FBI, although I don't think I could condemn everything they've ever done, because I'm sure some of the investigations and investigation of crime has been beneficial, but that could be accomplished through Justice Department within our states. We wouldn't reject that portion of it.
So there's you recognize that voice, I assume.
Absolutely. A little younger sounding, but it's the same thing that he would say today or yesterday or tomorrow. This is an evil force that uses its power for politics to take down people who get out of line. So I was really happy to see that trending on Twitter and elsewhere the other day when someone dug it up. So
that's Dr. Ron Paul, the voice of a much younger Dr. Ron Paul in 1988, but yeah, very prescient. And so he's commenting on the nature of the institution, and that this is what happens when big government gets too big, when these agencies and their appointed heads and the deep state entrenched bureaucracy becomes immovable, you get these types of institutional behaviors, these sort of abuses. And that's one of your big messages, I think, with your organization, Daniels. You're constantly, sounding the alarm on these types of things.
Yeah, of course. The global empire, the U.S. global empire, which costs us more than $1 trillion a year and does nothing but make enemies overseas. A very, very dumb foreign policy of interventionism and a domestic policy of interventionism, too. The government intervening in our domestic affairs, getting in bed with the social media and making sure that if you're not on board with the Ukraine operation, you get silenced. That's not these companies on their own acting, as you know very well, Patrick. That's the government acting in concert with the private sector. It really is the dictionary definition of fascism. That's breaking out across the U.S. And so obviously that's something that should be opposed by all Americans.
And big government acting in concert with big corporate or transnational corporate cartels, isn't that the source of the dysfunction of the management of the so-called global pandemic over the last couple of years?
Well, absolutely. And a lot of it is in the name of profits and power. When companies are indemnified for the people they hurt, and you have millions that may well have been hurt or worse, then exactly, you have big government and big corporation, big pharma, big military industrial complex. This is not conspiracy theory stuff, because it's right out in front of us. They're not trying to hide it. There's no secret code out there that we have to unlock. It's right there in front of us, and you can see it as plain as day.
Yeah, I noticed, I don't know if you noticed as well, another clip that's trending on social media is the Dr. Anthony Fauci's doing a victory lap. He's doing a lot of these events, you know, in front of academic institutions, graduate ceremonies, little sort of summits, conferences. And I think he's getting ready for retirement, Daniel, because he seems to be really lapping up the adulation or what's left of it. So I think he'll probably be on his way out pretty soon. Do you think that might coincide with a potential flip in Congress and Senate? And would that also mean a little bit of a change in how Washington's going to, you know, push the pandemic fear button in the future? Do you think there might change in how Washington's going to, you know, push the pandemic fear button in the future? Do you think there might be a difference with different parties in control of this?
I'd like to hope so, but I guess I'm cynical. You know, the Republicans have said that, at least several Republicans have said that they would be looking into Fauci. But I wonder if the Republican majority leader in the Senate would allow that if the Senate does flip. If Mitch McConnell, is he someone to upset the apple cart? You know, that's the problem, is you have people like him who've been in for decades, who don't want any change because they like the system just the way it is. They don't care if we've got to put on 10 masks and take 48 shots because it doesn't affect them. You know, it's a pandemic of the non-rich. So, but nevertheless, we're seeing this Fauci who just somehow psychologically addicted to this adulation. And as you say, making his victory lap. I would like to think that there will be some justice, maybe not in this world, but ultimately there will be some justice for what he's done to people.
Yeah. And also just there's a whole bevy of other characters in that gaggle as well. You named a few before, but the changing of the House control, the Senate control, McCarthy has been kind of, you know, very vocal, seems like he's the potential heir apparent there. Nancy Pelosi, you know, close to retirement, past retirement, some would say. What about, how's McCarthy has a strong position in the Congress? What about the Senate? What about if the Republicans take control of the Senate? Where would that leave McConnell? Because certainly there's a lot of what they might call Trumpian candidates who are looking very good for November. How do you see that whole House and Senate picture shaping up?
Well, McConnell is a survivor. I can't imagine him yielding any power whatsoever. He can be whatever he needs to be to continue in power. It would be great to see someone like him dethroned, but it's unlikely. And I think McCarthy is basically a House version of McConnell. He's definitely not one to upset the apple cart. But with that said, as you rightly point out, there have been some upstarts who not only are Trumpian, but you have, for example, Blake Masters out in Arizona. I've seen some quotes from him where he was telling people they need to read Lou Rockwell and antiwar.com and the Mises Institute. So that's pretty encouraging. You have someone like Anthony Sabatini in Florida, who's running for the U.S. House, who went toe-to-toe with one of the worst neocons in the U.S., Levine, at a debate, and Levine asked, well, what should we do about Ukraine? And he said, nothing. I'm not interested in starting a world war. And Levine couldn't handle it and flipped out. Mm-hmm. But Sabatini stood his ground. He's a young guy. He's smart. He's got a lot of energy. So if we can get a few people like that in power, I mean, right now you basically have a very tiny handful. You have people like Thomas Massie. And in the Senate, you have people like Rand Paul. But there aren't many. If you can get, you know, back when Dr. Paul was in the House, we had a group of about 20 members who would meet every Thursday and just compare notes. They didn't agree on everything, but just they all said the same thing. Just having somewhere to go and knowing that there were other members like them gave them a lot more courage to vote the right way. So if you can, you know, Dr. Paul always says, we don't need a majority, just need a critical mass of maybe 10 or 15 representatives and senators. And you can get things done. You really can.
Yeah, and your office there at that time in Washington was arguably very influential in building bridges across party lines with some of these foreign policy issues. So that's something that would be nice to see upstart again in Washington.
Yeah, the return of the coalition of the progressives and the anti-war conservatives, that would be something.
Yeah, yeah, and people like Dennis Kucinich, and there's all these great sort of crossover politicians. We definitely need to see more of that. You flagged up a few promising figures there. Hopefully that they will be successful in their endeavors. But we're gonna break on this hour right now. But I want to thank you, Daniel McAdams, director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, for joining us today on TNT.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That is Daniel McAdams. And do visit the Ron Paul Institute's website. It's a fantastic resource for foreign policy. And also check out the Liberty Report. It's on YouTube. That is Daniel and Ron Paul co-hosting that. That's on YouTube. It's on Rumble. I believe it's on a number of platforms now. So you can check that out as well. That's definitely somebody you want to be following for U.S. news and other reports. Look, we're going to take a break here at the top of the hour. I'm Patrick Henningsen. You're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll see you on the other side with our guest, Jason Leosatos. We'll be right back.